Hello and welcome to Risky Talk, the podcast where we talk about risk and how to talk about risk. I'm your host, David Spiegelhalter, and in this episode, we're tackling possibly the most urgent and contentious issue of the day, climate change.
4 out of 10 adults on the planet have never heard of climate change. Never heard of it. That's almost 2 billion people.
It's about telling stories as much as it is about showing people the facts and figures around the climate science.
A lot of the framing is about loss. Nobody likes losing, right? You can get different responses to people just by changing the frame.
What are the most effective ways to communicate about climate change? A few years ago, I had a crack at it myself when I co-presented a BBC documentary called Climate Change by Numbers. We tried to find entertaining ways to make some of the numbers around climate change come alive. I remember firing a paintball gun in a forest to illustrate Monte Carlo modelling. We were hoping to entertain and inform. But of course, there are lots of groups, both individuals and governments, who urgently want much, much more. They want to achieve major transformational change. Change in the way we behave as individuals and change in the way whole industries and economies operate. Now, communication is going to be vital if any of this is going to happen. And my guests today all have skin in the game as climate change communicators themselves and as behavioral scientists studying climate communications. Dr. Emily Shuckburgh, OBE, is an accomplished mathematician and climate scientist and also the director of Cambridge Zero. Emily, welcome to Risky Talk.
Oh, thank you, David.
Before I introduce the others, can you give us a quick sense of what your mission is with Cambridge Zero?
So Cambridge Zero is a new initiative of the University of Cambridge, which aims to bring all the resources of the university together to help support the delivery of a zero carbon world. So to focus specifically on the solutions.
Well, we're so pleased to have you here. We also have Dr. Sander van der Linden with us. Sander is director of the Cambridge Social Decision Making Laboratory. Welcome, Sander.
Pleasure to be on the show.
Sander, you're a social psychologist. So what kind of topics do you work on that are relevant to climate change?
So I study how people think, feel, and act on the issue of climate change. And so that entails how people assess evidence, how they perceive the risk, the emotions that they experience, as well as how people decide whether or not to act on the issue.
And finally, I'm delighted that we've got Dr. Anthony Lazowitz on the line from the USA. Anthony is the director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, David. Great to be with you.
So, Anthony, what does your work focus on at the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication?
Sure. Well, two broad things. One is research, and the other is public outreach based on that research. So on the research side, much like Sander, we study how Americans and other people around the world respond to this issue. So what do they know and misunderstand? How do they perceive the risks? What kinds of policies they support or oppose? What kinds of behaviors are they engaged in? And then what are the psychological, cultural, and political reasons why some people get really engaged? Others are kind of apathetic, and some are downright dismissive and hostile. And then based on all that research, we also have our own effort to engage at least the American public with a national radio program we call Climate Connections. And these are 90-second stories, a brand new one every day, Monday through Friday, that play on about 525 stations across the country. And they feature the voices of everyday people from every walk of life who are either experiencing the impacts of climate change right here, right now, or, even more importantly, rolling up their sleeves and taking action to actually address the issue within their own domain or sphere of influence. So great to be with you.
Oh, it's great. Well, we've got a fantastic panel of guests to discuss these issues. So let's get started. Can I just stand back a moment about, you know, what actually are you all trying to do? I'm chair of our Winton Centre in Cambridge, and our sort of mantra we drone on about the whole time is that we're seeking to inform people rather than persuade them. We want to empower people to make informed choices, and we work in health and all sorts of other areas on informed consent. But, you know, climate change communication is to do with change, getting people to change their behaviour. I mean, am I right in this? And you know, does this mean it's somewhat different from a lot of the other risk communication that we do and we talk about?
If what we're trying to achieve through our climate science communications is essentially better informing people so they make whatever decisions they want to make, then that's one perfectly laudable thing to want to do. And there are certain things you might want to try and do in order to make sure that that communication happens as effectively as possible. If what we're really wanting to do is to get people to take a particular course of action and change their behavior in certain ways, then actually you might question whether actually telling them about the climate science is the right thing to do in the first place. And so being really clear about what your goal of those communications are.
I completely agree, but do you think people are generally clear? I have listened to messages that it seems to be completely mixed up.
I think it's completely mixed up. And I think that actually, that's understandable, because if you think about the people who are communicating, let's take climate scientists just because I am one, but, you know, we have been studying, the changing climate. We've seen the changes. I'm a polar scientist. I've seen the changes and the scale of the changes, and it's horrifying. And so it's very difficult not to get personally involved and to want certain outcomes from your communication. And so trying to dissociate and step back from that and be really genuinely, as to the extent that one can be, as dispassionate as possible is challenging.
Yeah, Sandra, is it okay to use these behavioural science techniques that have been developed for behaviour change in this context where you're perhaps more trying to change attitudes?
Yeah, I have two big thoughts on that. The first thing I tell all of my undergraduate students in my influence class is that we're constantly influencing each other, whether we like it or not. By every word that you say, there is unintended consequences that you could not have anticipated on somebody else. Every time somebody comes to class, they hear things and they're influenced one way or another, either because I intend to by showing them evidence or talking about studies or psychology, or by accident. And every time they tell a story to somebody else, they're either intentionally or unintentionally influencing people all the time. So I think the influence process is part of being human. But what we want to do is do that in an ethical way. And I think that's the key issue. People think stuff all the time, and people don't know what other people are thinking. If I reveal to you what other people are thinking and that influences your behavior or you change your behavior, that has nothing to do with the information that I gave you. I just told you objectively what other people are doing. And I think that's an interesting distinction to draw. Now, the kind of explicit behavior change stuff, like do we want people to change? I think it's a moral question of what as a society we decide is normative. We don't want people to steal stuff, and we do change people's behavior when they steal stuff, and we all think that's okay. If we decide we want to do the same for climate change, then maybe that's an ethical thing to do.
Yeah, I know. I think we have to talk about ethics in this area because, about whether in what situations is it reasonable, in a sense, to try to persuade somebody either of a fact, that's correcting a misunderstanding, perhaps that seems fairly reasonable. But actually, there's a reason for doing that, and I'm sure when you do your studies, your some of your outcome measures might include things like intention and attitude and things like
Absolutely.
That. Which then we actually reveal perhaps what you are, what is the aim of what you're doing. Tony, how do you feel on this business of informing versus persuading?
Yeah, so I think it's important to recognize the messenger as well as the role that they're in because of the context they're in. So context is always king. If a woman goes in to see her doctor and her doctor runs a bunch of tests and the doctor comes back and says, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith, but I have to inform you that you have cancer," that's a fact. But that's a fact that comes with an enormous amount of weight, right? Enormous amount of emotional reaction, fear, concern, and perhaps motivation to do something about that. And then the doctor can follow up with a subsequent set of facts. And here are three different choices of, a prescription. It could be chemotherapy, could be something else that we want. That you need to know to are the options. And that's informing the patient of what those choices are. That seems to me a really nice example of what we think of as the prototypical scientist job in this issue, is to inform the public, inform policymakers, inform decision makers. Here is the threat. Here's the danger that we face now with this thing called climate change. And moreover, let's not stop there. Here are the range of potential solutions that can be done. That seems entirely appropriate. But the other thing to say here is that scientists are also citizens. And it is entirely okay and appropriate for a scientist to say, okay, I'm going to wear a different hat now, and I'm going to speak as a citizen who happens to be a particularly informed citizen because I happen to study this issue.
But how do you know which hat he's wearing? Because again, when you hear somebody talking, which hat are they wearing when they're being a scientist? Isn't there some issue about the scientific view with all that authority just carrying over into advocacy so easily?
Yes. And that's, I think, back to Emily's point, is where it's actually incumbent upon scientists to try to make that clear to their audiences. When they're speaking as a scientist, that is trying to be true to the data and the evidence as best they can, even if that's inconvenient, versus what their ambitions are as a citizen that happens to care about the future that we all are going to live in together.
Okay, Sander, so tell me how a company might use psychology in order to change their customers' behavior.
Yeah, so this is what Bob Cialdini, who's a social psychologist, calls ethical influence. And the way they do this is, so Opower was a famous example of an energy company, and you might ask, why would an energy company actively encourage their customers to consume less energy? But they were a startup, and they were, you know, more inclined to do something about climate change. And so they basically gave customers a bill, and on that bill, there was comparative information about the level of energy that their close neighbors were consuming. So people saw their own consumption relative to that of their neighbors, and they found that people would adjust their own energy consumption to the level of their neighbors, which is kind of conforming with the local norm. And again, they weren't telling people what they should be doing with their lives, but that is just the behavior that emerged. And later they found that sometimes this doesn't really work if somebody's doing well and they're consuming less energy and they found out they're doing much better than their neighbors, they start to backslide and conform to the others. But they find out if they put a smiley face on the bill and saying you're doing good, that reinforces the behavior. And just so a small incentive like that actually had an enormous effect on, well, not the effect actually was small. It was about a 1-2% increase. But when you scale that across all of the hundreds of thousands of customers, it really added up. And they think that's ethical, or we talk about it that way, because we're just revealing actual information to people. And that's why I'm always confused when people say that knowledge doesn't matter, because what we're doing in those experiments is just exposing people to information they hadn't considered before. That is what other people are actually doing. And then, you know, to the last point, David, your point about wearing different hats. When I give a talk, I always ask the audience, because I'm generally interested in this, is whether they want scientists to advocate for evidence-based policy. Because ultimately, you know, scientists are paid in often by tax dollars. And if the public wants us to advocate for science and evidence-based policy, if that norm is changing, then maybe that's legitimate for scientists to start considering doing that. But if the public doesn't want it, that's another story, right? And we can have a conversation. But it's kind of interesting that scientists talk about it, whereas we're less often asking the public about what they want from scientists.
But there's a difference between advocating for evidence to be used in policymaking, which I think no one would disagree with, right, and advocating for a particular policy, which I think is, you know, many might consider is going beyond the role of many of scientists.
Okay, that's a fair point. I think most scientists would perhaps advocate. I think I like what you said earlier about risk and benefits. I think most scientists would advocate a range of, as Tony was saying, plausible solutions to climate change, and then we have to communicate the benefits and harms and debate each of these solutions to see which one is going to be best. But you know, what's best means, you know, something good for some people and bad for other people, and that's a very complex political question.
Winners and losers.
Winners and losers, that's right.
Okay, so we agree that communicating about climate change involves informing different audiences, both about the science and the potential options available, but can also involve ethical persuasion, at least to get people to take notice of the issue and not be misled by false claims. Now, the next step is to learn about the different audiences so we can tailor different communications. So first, we need to shut up and listen. So what do we know about the attitudes of different groups of people towards climate change? What do they know already? What do they worry about? What's driving their attitudes? Anthony, I know you've done a lot of work on this in the US. Can you kick us off here?
Sure. Well, actually, we work at many different levels, so let me take the global scale. And first, a few key things that we need to understand from that perspective. One is that the United States and the UK and Australia and Canada are outliers. These are the only countries where you really find an organized climate denial movement. And so, yes, we tend to fixate on, you know, this debate over the science, quote unquote, debate. But that's, you got to understand, that's really primarily limited to these four English-speaking countries. But more importantly, at the global scale, we found that 4 out of 10 adults on the planet have never heard of climate change. Okay? Never heard of it. That's almost 2 billion people. And that's despite decades of science, you know, all the scientific reports, the geopolitical meetings, the COPs, you know, the big international conferences on climate change negotiations. Despite all of that, nearly 40% of the world have never heard of it. And that can be as high as two-thirds or even three-quarters of certain countries, like, say, Bangladesh, poster child of climate vulnerability. Two-thirds of Bangladeshis have never heard of it, which is not to say they're not keenly aware of changes in their local climate. They are, okay, because people are exquisitely attuned to these changes because often their lives depend on it. They may be subsistence farmers, for example. But what they lack is the concept of climate change to make sense of those changes that are happening around them. And even more importantly, they don't have the concept of climate change to help them make and inform their decisions going forward. These are countries that are building entire new cities. You know, where do we build them? Where do we site our hospitals, our schools, our roads? To what tolerances should we be building? What crops are we going to grow in our country? If you're making those decisions without the benefit of understanding the risks of climate change, you're probably putting your money in on some really bad bets. So anyway, that's just a global perspective that's really important. Last thing just to say, though, is that we also see a huge north-south divide. The developed world far more aware of climate change, the developing world much less so. But when you ask how personally at risk are you of the impacts of climate change, we find the opposite pattern, that people in the developed world, like the UK, like the US, like most of Europe, et cetera, say, not so much. It's not going to affect me. It's mostly going to impact people in places far away. Whereas people in the developing world who at least are aware of the issue, among those people, they're very concerned, much more concerned than people in the developed world, and quite rightly, because they are, in most cases, much more vulnerable and much less resilient to the impacts.
Well, fascinating to hear about that international perspective. But, of course, we do hear a lot about, you know, the arguments and the contested opinions in, for example, the U.S. So how do people break into different groups in the U.S.?
So many years ago, we started a project that we call Global Warming Six Americas, recognizing, and back to your principles of core communication, first principle is know your audience. That's why you shut up and listen, because you want to know who your audience is. So who are they? Because only once you understand who that audience is, can you then structure your communications in a way to meet them where they are, not where you are. Okay, I cannot stress that enough. How do you meet and engage people where they are? And in the U.S., we've identified these six Americas, and they range on a spectrum from a group we call the alarmed, fully convinced it's happening, human-caused, urgent, strongly support action. That's about 31% of the country today. Then the concerned, who are also convinced it's happening, human-caused and serious, but still tend to think that the impacts is far away in time and space, so it doesn't seem as urgent. Then a group we call the cautious, still on the fence, is it real or not? Then a group we call the disengaged, who's basically, like many other people around the world, like, I don't think I even know anything about this. I've never heard of climate change. And then a group we call the doubtful. These are people who say, it's probably not real. But if it is, it's natural, just natural cycles, nothing we have anything to do with, nothing we can do anything about. And then last but not least, at about 10% of the American public are what we call the dismissive, who are firmly convinced it's not real, it's not human caused, it's not serious. And moreover, the great majority of whom literally tell us they're conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax, it's scientists making up data, it's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty, it's a get-rich scheme by Al Gore and his friends, and many other such narratives. But the critical thing to just end with here is that that's only 10%. But there are really loud 10%. There are really vocal 10%. There are 10% that's more than well represented in our government. And they have tended to dominate the public square to such an extent that they've actually intimidated most of the other 90% of the population into not talking about the issue. And if nobody talks about it, then it's very difficult as a society to say, yes, this is a crucial, urgent issue to address. So that basic element of communication, talking about the issues, turns out to be one of the foundational gaps in at least the United States, and I would suggest in at least many other countries around the world.
Can I just briefly go over to ask Emily about how that compares with the situation in the UK? I think of these different sort of tribal groups. How does that, is that reflected in the UK as well?
I think it probably is to an extent, right? So I'm a climate scientist by background, so I've spent much of the last 25 years trying to get over the message of climate science around the risks associated with climate change. And it has undoubtedly been quite frustrating at times to cut through some of the rhetoric and the vested interests and so forth. And I guess some of the things that we've been hearing here about the different groups, I mean, probably the percentages are a bit different, but there's still a similar sorts of different types of people.
Okay, Anthony, we're talking about, you know, education and climate science and things like that. How much is this a matter of knowledge and understanding in the different groups?
So it depends. So here's where we're going to get into the psychology, because we also find there's a fair amount of motivated reasoning going on at the extremes. So one of the things
that's... Can you explain what that means?
Of course. So at least in the United States, and I dare say in the UK as well, one of the major drivers of this is politics. Okay, I know I'm breaking news here, but you know, the politics is really, really toxic at this issue. Climate change is now more politically polarized in the United States than issues like abortion. So where basically Democrats and liberals are very, very concerned about climate change and want to take aggressive action, and basically conservative Republicans basically dismiss it. It's still a common refrain that this is not a problem at all. So politics is a big part of it. Even deeper than that are deeper commitments to value systems, a deeper worldview, which we label as egalitarian worldview versus an individualistic or a radical individualistic worldview. But here's the critical caveat. That's really driven by those people in those far at either ends of the spectrum, the alarmed, who tend to be much more egalitarian and concerned about climate change, and the dismissive, who are much more in that radical individualism perspective. For them, this is about their identity. This is about their deep moral and value commitments, about their visions of a preferred society. And as a result, they're deeply motivated to then cherry pick, interpret the evidence in such a way that it seems to reinforce their basic conclusions about the way the world should work. So if you're anti-government, you just inherently believe that all government is bad, that there's too much taxation, too much regulation, government's too big. We, in the famous words or infamous words of Grover Norquist here in the United States, who said, "I want to shrink government to the size that I can drown it in a bathtub." If that's your worldview, then you see climate change as the mother of all threats, right? Because it is this giant collective action problem. There's no way that through our individual actions collectively we can solve this. We have to do this through system change. And one of the major ways that we do major structural change in our societies is government. Yes, they often will argue about the science, but you scratch below the surface and what you find is really going on, what they're often really motivated by, is this deep fear that this is going to lead to bigger government, which is, again, a violation of their deeper held values.
So is there a group that, you know, improving of knowledge and understanding through better communication, you think might actually change their opinion?
So absolutely. So what knowledge are we talking about? The alarmed are highly motivated right now to take action, but they don't know what to do. Okay. As a community, we've done a far better job with that group of explaining the threat than we have the solutions. And so one of the key things that we really try to emphasize is how important it is to give people not just the solutions, but what's called in psychological terms, a sense of efficacy. There's a deep literature here about how important it is to give people solutions that they know of, that they have the ability to enact those solutions, and most importantly, that if they do them, it will make a difference. So one communication need is to communicate to the alarmed and even the concerned, here are the things that you can do. But to the other groups that are mostly in the middle, they really just don't know that much about the issue. There is still a need to basically communicate five key facts, okay? And through our work, we think it basically comes down to five key facts that everyone ought to know. And moreover, we boiled those down to just 10 key words. A friend of mine converted them to a haiku, so I'll give you that one. Scientists agree. It's real. It's us. It's bad. But there's hope. That's basically what everyone needs to know. You know, if you're managing water resources, you need to know a whole lot more about climate change, no question. But for most people, they're going to have limited shelf space devoted to this issue or any complex issue, frankly. And those are the basics.
Sandra, does this reflect your experience as well?
Yeah, I mean, Tony and I do a lot of research together, and I would agree with that on a lot of levels. Perhaps a good way to think of it is that knowledge is often necessary but not sufficient for people to act on information. And, you know, from everything in psychology, we know that people are experiencers rather than analytical processors most of the time. And that's important to keep in mind, I think, when we try to educate people on this issue. And yeah, there are people who are motivated in their beliefs. And I think, you know, it's good to realize that these are normal processes to some extent. Our attention is selective. That's the way the brain reacts to information. David, if you didn't make choices about what's important to you on a daily basis, life would get very complicated if you try to consume everything that comes at you. And so we are inherently selective in what we choose to attend to. But when that gets into overdrive and people attach political beliefs and motivations to really distorting reality to how they want to view the world. And as Tony rightly said, I think you find those people at the extremes, not so much in the middle. And I think the hopeful takeaway from that is that people in the middle are receptive to certain kinds of evidence when appropriately communicated. But perhaps people on the extremes are more difficult. And that is a challenge because they do have an outsized influence on the climate debate in places like the US, Australia, and perhaps also the UK.
Yeah. Emily, I mean, you do a lot of communication. You know, how do you tailor your messages to these different audiences? I was thinking of extremes on both sides who are extremely vocal.
So I do a lot of communications to business leaders, people in the financial sector, et cetera. And in that professional context, if I'm presenting the climate science, I've always found that people are very receptive because I think that they're in that professional context, they perhaps are more accepting of taking on board facts in a rational way than they might be in other contexts. And oftentimes I've seen that follow through into, you know, actual action as a consequence of that. If you're talking more generally in a different setting where people are less in that sort of rational frame of mind, then I have, as I said earlier, I've always found that the really critical thing is to make things relevant to people's lives. And actually in both circumstances, it's about telling stories as much as it is about showing people the facts and figures around the climate science.
You co-authored one of the Ladybird expert series on climate change with Tony Juniper and Prince Charles as well. So that aims to be very simple and accessible. You know, given the complexity of climate science, how do you start doing that?
Well, actually, so there were two things around that. So first of all, there was a challenge in terms of taking... Well, in fact, you know, essentially we had the whole of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, condensed down into 26 pages of 200 words, which was quite a challenge in itself.
That's but 200 words altogether, or 200 words
each. 200 words on each page.
Yeah, exactly.
But coming back to our earlier points about the audiences and segmenting the audiences, we very much didn't want that book to be preaching to the converted. So we wanted to be reaching sectors of society that wouldn't ordinarily be, you know, thinking about climate change as an issue. And so we were very careful in terms of the language that we used to make sure that it would be appealing to those audiences.
Climate science is complicated. Mm-hmm. So what are the particular issues that present a real challenge in communicating to people?
I think the overwhelming thing that has been difficult to communicate to people about climate change is the fact that for many people, it has been seen as a distant problem. So either distant in terms of something that will happen long into the future, or distant in terms of something that happens to people who live elsewhere rather than to them personally. And then it comes back to whether or not they feel personally at risk. I think one of the things that's been really interesting over the last 18 months or so, if we've seen the rise of Greta Thunberg and Fridays for Future and the school strikes and so forth, is that that has actually been a way of taking what has seemed like a very distant problem and making it actually much more immediate, because these are young people who are saying, hang on a minute, this isn't a distant problem for us. This is our future at stake. And so it's almost given a visual representation to something that we've been struggling for a very long time from the climate science community to try to be able to explain.
But climate science uses models, they're making predictions about the future. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen. How do you face up to that in telling people about that?
Well, as you know more than anybody, David, right? All those words that you just said, uncertainty, yeah. You know, it's inherent in what we do from a scientific analysis perspective. And yet there's something that is very difficult to communicate. And you have to be very careful to ensure that that things are not lost in translation, that what we're trying to explain from the climate science side of things isn't interpreted incorrectly by people when they hear what we're saying. So a lot of the time, if we talk about uncertainty, people hear that we don't know what we're talking about, and somehow we've got to make sure that we don't mean that at all.
How do you best do that?
Well, no, you're the expert on telling me this. I know you're supposed to tell me.
People, if I come up and say, "Oh, it's only a model, it's only a theory," you run models, they always give different answers, different predictions. What's going to happen? You know, how can you have any confidence in what's going to happen in the future?
Yeah, so I do think that this is about creating a whole narrative. So there are some things that we absolutely know and we can observe. And for some people, that is the most compelling thing. So, for example, one thing that I always start off my scientific presentations on is a description of the ice cores that we drill in Antarctica, because what happens is that the air gets trapped in the snow as it falls, and then that means when we drill down through the ice, we can recover the actual air that was in the atmosphere, you know, up to a million or so years ago in the past, and we can analyze it. So that's actual data, and through that we can see how the climate has naturally changed over hundreds of thousands of years. And that's a question that I often used to get asked. People used to say, "Oh, climate change, but hasn't the climate always changed?" And it has. But we can also see how different those levels of carbon dioxide in the past were compared to today's levels. And so demonstrate that today's climate change is vastly outside the natural cycle of change. So I think it's those sorts of things. And even more so, if we are able to actually, sometimes I take samples of ice core into public audiences. And if people are actually able to hold the bits of ice core themselves and listen to the bubbles of burst from the ice, then somehow they find that even more compelling because they've had that personal interaction with the evidence base. So I think some of those aspects are really important for grounding and building up a sense of trust. People are used to, you know, trusting things based on their own intuition and experiences. So if you can give people a sense of that, then I feel that they are more likely to take on trust the things that they don't have the ability to be able to actually test for themselves.
Exactly, because these are facts in the sense that you then are trying to communicate. But when you're doing the models, we have a lot of uncertainty about the future. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in just what kind of language you might use to a fairly naive audience when describing the fact that you do run models many times and they come up with different conclusions, and that gives you some idea of what the risks are.
Yeah, but I think that word is key, risks. So I think that people, people are used to risks in their everyday life, aren't they? In a way that I think they're less used to using the terminology of uncertainty. So I think describing things in terms of the risks is a much more understandable, it fits in more with people's sense of how the world works than if we start talking in too scientific a way about the uncertainty on future projections.
So you, when you're communicating, you don't express certainty about what's going to happen.
We can't.
No, exactly. No, but some people do. So you the language is of risk.
Absolutely, the language is of risk.
Can I springboard off that?
Sorry, yeah, I was about to come back to you.
So first of all, I want to make a broader point, and that is that the climate community, and it's mostly because it originally came out of climate scientists, I think have allowed the opponents of action to push them into a really unfair double standard. I mean, we're talking about making big social, economic, and political decisions. Why is climate science policy being held to a completely different and much more higher standard of evidence than all of our other massive social decision making? We're more certain about the reality and the causes and the impacts of climate change than we are about cigarette smoking harming human health. And as societies, we make huge decisions. Like, let me just take our good friends sitting there in the UK. You are in the middle of taking a massive experiment in Brexit. Do you have that all completely modeled out? Are you completely certain of exactly what's going to happen? Okay, that's and yet you're...
I think we should keep off that.
You're more, and there are many, many, many decisions, economic decisions, political decisions. I mean, do we go into war in Iraq? Okay. Nobody had that certainty. And yet, for some reason, our community has allowed the other side to demand that we need to have 100% certainty about the future projected by climate change or climate change science in order to make a decision. That's ridiculous. We don't assume that level of certainty in any major decision that we make in our personal lives, let alone our national lives. So one is, I think we've totally screwed that up. The second is that language of risk does open the conversation with specific audiences. So Emily mentioned this with business office audiences. Yeah. I found this with, say, leaders in the financial industry. Okay, these are people who live and die based on risk. And when you explain that climate change is uncertain and that, in fact, when we look at these projections, there are what we call fat tails. You know, yes, there are best projections, and right now we think that, you know, central tendency, best projection is that if we continue on current paths, the world will warm by, say, 3 to 3.5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. That's just the best estimate. The fact is that there's this long tail where there's probably a 5 to 10% chance that it could be runaway climate change with temperatures going much, much higher than that, which would be completely catastrophic. Not that 3 degrees is any picnic. So, and when you explain that concept to people in the financial industry, they immediately get it because they say, look, if there was something out there that had a 5% or 10% chance of killing my company or killing my investment, I would do everything possible to hedge against that. Okay. And just to put this in very concrete terms, if one out of every 20 airplanes exploded in midair, would any of us fly? And yet that's essentially the risk that we're taking with the one planet, the one spacecraft, if you will, that we all have.
Okay, let's just take stock for a moment. We've heard that business audiences, they understand the language of risk and probability. And the groups in the middle, the cautious, the disengaged, who tend not to know that much about climate change, they're responsive to learning about evidence and to being informed. And we've also heard about the alarmed, you know, this group most worried about climate change, and they want clear guidance about what to do, what actions to take. They need to feel that there's things they can do that will really make a difference. But what about the dismissive? You know, that group, you know, maybe 10% who are skeptics. We've heard about the politics and values associated with that view, but how do you tailor messages towards them? Sander?
Yeah, so we've been doing quite a bit of research on what facts are so-called non-polarizing facts. So what facts do people accept in a way that doesn't drive people further apart on the issue? And we found through lots of studies, actually, is that when we stress that over 97% of climate scientists, based on the evidence, have concluded that human-caused climate change is happening, most people are willing to accept that fact. Because one, you're not asking them to overhaul their worldview entirely. You're just asking them to accept the fact that scientists think that global warming is happening. But it seems to be a gateway to opening up a larger conversation without necessarily telling people that they're wrong in their beliefs right out the gate. And so it's an interesting position to start a conversation. And we found that that's quite successful across the political spectrum. And I think it's also interesting because it's what Tony was saying earlier about, you know, maybe people aren't necessarily denying the science and something called solution aversion, that people are averse to the solutions that are being proposed based on the science. And I think decoupling that it's not so much that people are really sort of hating on the science, it's more what the science implies for them politically. And I think the scientific consensus is a nice way to actually decouple that. And there you're actually stressing certainty. I mean, there is some margin of error around is it 99%? Is it, we have some colleagues who engage in this debate, right? Is it 99.9% or 97%? But the big point is that it's most scientists, and that's just on the issue of whether humans are contributing to climate change. So we're not talking about the complex future predictions and all of the uncertainty. That's a nice sort of isolated case where you can say, actually, there's a lot of certainty, not uncertainty, but certainty on that particular fact. And people seem quite ready to to accept that fact, and then they're a little bit more open to other ideas about climate change as well.
How can you reduce this idea of distance that Emily and Tony have talked about, that where people feel, oh, well, it's a long way away, it's the other side of the world, it's nothing to do with me, even though they might believe that this is actually happening?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think Emily made a great point by, you know, the sort of bringing the actual ice into not, you know, not in the, you know, way of see global warming, here's an ice ball. You know, in the sense of actually educating people about the science, because the human brain, and this is we wrote this paper a while back where we had five lessons for people, and this is the first one, is that the human brain privileges experience over analysis. And that's, you know, people learn through intuition and through experience. And if they can actually experience the evidence in a concrete way, that's just a much more powerful way for people to learn. I love this quote from Mark Twain, who once said, you know, a man who carries a cat by the tail learns something he can learn in no other way. Now, you should never carry a cat by the tail, right? But it gets the point across. The one I also like is if I ask you to judge the content of what, you know, what does peanut butter taste like without ever having tasted peanut butter, but you have to judge it based on the ingredient list. It's a very difficult thing for people to do, right? You experience the world, and that's how we gather knowledge. And in a way, scientific consensus, if you think of it in a Bayesian way, it's also a form of experience sampling. And we have another paper called The Experience of Consensus, is that when you actually show people, and John Oliver has a really funny segment where he brings out 97 scientists on stage, and when you experience the numbers, that's how people come to think of what that actually means. And local impacts, I think that's the other thing I would say, you know, when you have the opportunity and when the science is, when you can actually relay trends and changing weather patterns to climate change, pointing out for people locally what the impacts are, but also how they can locally implement knowledge about what to do about it. And that's the thing about local knowledge. I think those are sort of key points.
And what about, you know, people just not wanting to give things up? You know, why should I lose something for some rather ill-defined benefit sometime in the future?
Yeah, that's another great one. And again, that paper, that's kind of one of the lessons that we attack, is the gain versus loss framing. Because the whole climate change debate, and when we sort of distilled the literature and started thinking about this, a lot of the framing is about loss. Nobody likes losing, right? This is not a good beneficial frame for people to think about. If climate change to you just means having to lose things, having to change your behavior and make sacrifices, you know, lose land, lose, income, sacrifice, all sort of things, that's not a very nice way for people to engage people, really. And so you could take the same issue and use a gain frame instead of a loss frame. And of course, Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize laureate psychologist and prospect theory, who's done a lot of research on this, kind of shows that you can get different responses to people just by changing the frame. So if instead you say to people, this is not, you know, if we act on climate change and if we invest in it, then, you know, this is the loss in national income per head per capita, that's a loss frame. That doesn't sound good as a policy proposal. But if you reframe that as a foregone gain, saying this is what you would have gained because it goes up every year, but now you're gaining a little bit less, you're still gaining. And that's a good thing, right? And so just that simple tweak in framing can mean a lot to how people perceive an issue.
Emily.
No, so building off that, one thing that I said at the start, I've taken over, I'm director of Cambridge Zero, which is all focused around solutions. And one thing that has been really interesting to me is how that changing in framing from being a climate scientist talking about the doom and gloom of the future of the world to a more hopeful frame focused on the solutions completely changes the picture. We have, you know, the amount of energy and excitement and enthusiasm that we're starting to generate of people wanting to be involved. And I think it's particularly when it's involved down at a local level again, so that was things that they can actually do and get involved in. It really starts to snowball, and it completely changes the whole dialogue. We've seen in Cambridge how that can also be about getting people excited in the innovation process itself. So one example there, we have in the engineering department, they're working on developing electric planes and next generation aviation. And they're all excited because one of the challenges in the aviation sector is it normally takes decades to develop any new aircraft engine or aircraft design. And we don't have decades. So what they've been doing is they've been taking innovation techniques from Formula One and bringing those into the lab. And by doing that, they have, they claim to have reduced the research, innovation and development timescale by a factor of 100. Now, you can imagine how exciting that is for an engineer. And so they are all super excited about getting involved in that. So it's not just the product itself, it's also the innovation process that becomes very exciting. On the food example, university's catering service looked to see how they could reduce their carbon footprint. And one of the biggest ways you can reduce carbon footprint is by removing ruminant meats. And so that's what they did. And then, but it wasn't just that they removed ruminant meats. They also looked at the way in which the food was being presented as options in terms of that. And as a consequence, reduced the footprint of the catering service by some 30%. But now, other outlets in the university, catering managers and all the colleges, are starting to get excited about how to do this too. And so in my own college, the catering manager, you know, I can't, every time I see him, I go into college, he's been sending his chefs off on vegetarian training courses and winning competitions for the vegetarian offerings they're serving up. He even started trying to serve insects the other day in the college, didn't go down too well. but you know, this is about doing something different and a bit innovative, and he's been given more freedom than he's ever been given before to do things differently. And he's finding it very exciting, and he's we're coming down to your smiley faces. He's getting awards for doing it, and suddenly he's the most popular kid on the block kind of thing. And that's where I think actually none of this. What's interesting on all of this is that none of the whole climate science motivation almost gets lost in the story, and everyone gets wrapped up in actually this is an exciting, innovative, creative new way of doing things.
And you feel that can work across a wide range of different audiences?
I feel like it does. And I think critical things are the positive framing, that it's hope, the sense of, somebody mentioned earlier, the sense of efficacy, because, you know, you're involved in the solutions. You yourself can contribute in a meaningful way to it. That seems to be important as well. And then building up a sense of collective momentum as well, that this is a positive future.
I would love to springboard off of that. So I want to go back just a moment to what Sandra was saying very rightly about the power of experience, and that the brain does privilege experience over analysis. But it's also, you don't have to rely on one's own direct experience, okay? I mean, if it did, we never would have survived, because we'd all have eaten the poison berries, right? The point of this is that it's also about vicarious experience, that we can learn from each other. And the most powerful way that human beings have ever created to communicate from my experience to your understanding is a story. So if I tell you a story, don't eat that berry because one of our tribal members ate that and they died horribly, you will never eat that berry without having to actually do it yourself, right? And having to experience it itself. And when it comes to climate change, that's our challenge, is that we can't wait for everybody to personally be harmed by climate change to take action, because by that time, we're overcommitted to really serious problems. There's huge lag times in this. So vicarious experience becomes important, and that's going to bring me back to this radio program I mentioned before called Climate Connections, because what we're doing with that is hearing the voices of everyday people telling the stories about how they are personally already being harmed right here, right now, so it's not distant, but also the stories of the people who are taking action and making a difference. And so let me just start, I'll just use this story as an example, because it does actually help address some of the larger challenges that we talked about. And that's in the American state of Georgia. There's a utility called Georgia Power that is pretty much got a monopoly over most of the electricity market in the state. Monopolies are a great business model. I highly recommend it if you can get one. And they had set the rules so that homeowners who put solar panels on their roof could not sell their electricity into the grid. Why would you want the competition? So in that state, the Sierra Club, environmental group, partnered with the Atlanta Tea Party. So let me say that again. The Sierra Club partnered with the Tea Party, this far, right libertarian kind of a group, to fight those regulations, and they beat them twice. And now homeowners can sell their solar panel generated electricity into the grid. So why would these two groups partner like this? The Sierra Club, easy to understand, bunch of greenies, tree huggers, they care about climate change. Okay. Why would the Tea Party do this when they don't even believe that climate change is real? Because this particular solution, putting solar panels on your roof, aligned with their underlying values of individual liberty, individual freedom, self-reliance. Who is some company or some government to tell me what I can and cannot do with my own home? Why should I not be able to participate in the free market if I'm producing surplus electricity? Okay. And that is an example of the art of politics. How can you find those policies that can attract the support of completely different groups who will support it for completely different reasons? But the point is that you got the policy passed. And in fact, those groups went on to find other things to work on together. They don't agree about lots of stuff, but they have since become affectionately known as the Green Tea Party.
That's
amazing.
Great story. Well, we've covered a lot today. We've talked about deciding the aims of the communication and listening to different audiences, crafting tailored messages, and some of the challenges and even solutions to communicating complex climate science, and how insights from psychology can be used by policymakers and others to encourage engagement and understanding and even behavior change, provided it's all a form of ethical persuasion. And that brings us to the end, and it's time to say a real thank you to my great guests, Emily Shuckburgh, Sander van der Linden, and Anthony Leisowitz, and say goodbye from me and the Risky Talk team.
Risky Talk is produced by Ilan Goodman at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in the University of Cambridge.